Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air with Sarah Huber.
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KZSU Stanford at 90.1 on the FM dial. You can pick us up on the internet as well at kzsulive.stanford.edu. Today we have a special pre-recorded show, so please don't call us today, but put a note in your calendar for next week. Sherry, you'll be back then.
I will. Back from the beautiful Big Sur coast of California.
Yes, Esalen.
Esalen. It was a very strange experience, I must tell you, being up in Calaveras County this morning, where it's 106 degrees.
Oh, my gosh.
Packing for the coast where it's, I don't know, freezing.
50?
Right. It's just all, I mean, it's, for me, it's almost impossible for my mind to wrap around this possibility that in a few short hours I'll be freezing.
Yes. Yes. So. And looking for sunshine, I assume.
Looking for sunshine. California is a remarkable place.
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
I mean, just a 2-3 hours away, a person can go from sweltering to freezing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
In July.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's probably some sweet spot in the middle there.
No,
somewhere.
There is not. Not in the middle. I can promise you there's nothing in the middle.
It's too hot or too cold.
Must be somewhere, right on the border of those, but it's not in the middle. I think it's, 15 feet away from the coast or something.
Yes.
Yeah. It goes pretty quickly once you get over there.
Absolutely. Great. Well, we have some exciting stuff to talk about today, and I want to start with a short excerpt from a book called Life of Pi, and the author is Yann Martell, and he has a short chapter here. I must say a word about fear. It is life's only true opponent. Only fear can defeat life. It is a clever, treacherous adversary, how well I know. It has no decency, respects no law or convention, shows no mercy. It goes for your weakest spot, which it finds with unerring ease. It begins in your mind, always. One moment you are feeling calm, self-possessed, happy. Then fear, disguised in the garb of mild-mannered doubt, slips into your mind like a spy. Doubt meets disbelief, and disbelief tries to push it out. But disbelief is a poorly armed foot soldier. Doubt does away with it with little trouble. You become anxious. Reason comes to do battle for you. You are reassured. Reason is fully equipped with the latest weapons technology. But to your amazement, despite superior tactics and a number of undeniable victories, reason is laid low. You feel yourself weakening, wavering. Your anxiety becomes dread. Fear next turns fully to your body, which is already aware that something terribly wrong is going on. Already your lungs have flown away like a bird and your guts have slithered away like a snake. Now your tongue drops dead like an opossum while your jaw begins to gallop on the spot. Your ears go deaf. Your muscles begin to shiver as if they had malaria and your knees to shake as though they were dancing. Your heart strains too hard while your sphincter relaxes too much. And so with the rest of your body. Every part of you, in the manner most suited to it, falls apart. Only your eyes work well. They always pay proper attention to fear. Quickly, you make rash decisions. You dismiss your last allies, hope, and trust. There, you've defeated yourself. Fear, which is but an impression, has triumphed over you. The matter is difficult to put into words. For fear, real fear, such as shakes you to your foundation, such as you feel when you are brought face to face with your mortal end, nestles in your memory like a gangrene. It seeks to rot everything, even the words with which to speak of it. So you must fight hard to express it. You must fight hard to shine the light of words upon it. Because if you don't, if your fear becomes a wordless darkness that you avoid, perhaps even manage to forget, you open yourself to further attacks of fear because you never truly fought the opponent who defeated you.
Mm.
Wow.
Interesting, huh?
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, there are a couple of places where I would go to an au contraire.
Au contraire.
Perspective.
Uh-huh.
And maybe it's it's just a matter of how one breaks life down into manageable chunks to be able to take a look at it. Because to me, what he's lumping many, many things together under one label.
Yes.
So fear, what most people call fear, is a story. Right? And it's the reactions that he so beautifully describes in the body to the story. If somebody, if you're walking down a dark alley at night and suddenly you hear movement behind you, your heart would probably start pounding and your palms might get sweaty, and as adrenaline rushed through your body. Now, people call that fear, but is it really? I would say it's alert. So you're right there. And he uses that image of not taking your eyes off of fear. Everything else is falling apart in a big hurry, but you don't take your eyes off of fear. So there you are, hyper alert. Because there may be danger. So now we're in the fight or flight mode.
Yes.
The adrenaline is rushing through the body, and it's preparing you to do whatever. Now, many, many, many people that I've talked to describe that in the first, in the actual moment of something life-threatening happening, there are none of the things that people think about as fear. There is a tremendous amount of energy in the body, absolute presence. Time slows down. Life becomes very spacious, and then whatever happens happens.
Yes.
So it could be a car is coming at you, and there's this spaciousness. Maybe the car hits you. Maybe it doesn't hit you. I've talked to people who are having that slowed down experience as they're turning the steering wheel of the car. And then at the last second, the turn is made and they miss the accident. I've talked to other people who have that experience and they don't miss the accident. The next thing they know, they wake up somewhere and either can or can't remember the actual moment of impact. So the kind of fear that, to me, he's talking about is different from that, from the adrenaline rushing through your body, from the really present. So I would describe what he's talking about as, or I would label it, conditioning. I would even go so far as to call it conditioned self-hatred.
Yes.
Because it's that adversarial relationship.
Yes.
There is something creeping into your mind trying to undermine you, trying to destroy your confidence, trying to convince you that something awful is going to happen to you.
Yes.
Creating that story of gloom and doom and despair that is going to undo you.
Yes.
I don't think that that's fear.
Yes.
Not if fear is what you feel when somebody comes up behind you and pops a balloon or...
Yes. Yeah, because the experience he's describing is there's nothing actually in the moment that's life-threatening that's going on.
We don't actually know what has happened.
Yes.
There's just doubt coming in.
Yes.
And anxiety and insecurity. We don't know what the story is because he's not telling us what the story is.
Yes.
Except that something awful is going to happen. We get that sense from it.
Yes.
And the piece of it that is interesting to me is that notion that if you don't confront this, if you let this, whatever this is, whether we want to go with his label of a fear or mind conditioned self-hatred, if we don't confront it, if we let it become some Now, of course, I don't agree that you have to use words on it. What we have to use on it is conscious, compassionate awareness. Uh-huh. But we do have to be in relationship with it such that it is not allowed to just lurk somewhere outside our conscious awareness, uh-huh. somewhere behind conscious awareness, where it exists as a threat, as a yes. potential threat. All yes. It kind of lurks and looms.
Yes.
We have to turn our attention to it so that we take away from it the power that I would say our fear gives to it.
Yes.
So I become frightened of it. In other words, I have a story going about this thing that can come out and overtake me and destroy me. And it's that story that does the damage, not
Absolutely.
Whatever it is that might be
Right.
lurking back there.
Right.
So when I bring conscious, compassionate awareness to whatever is lurking, the story goes away.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing there unexamined.
Yes. That's what I was thinking about as I was reading it. What he's talking about is the story.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing actually
going on.
Yeah. Which sounds a lot like conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Making up something about what's going to happen in the future, how it's not going to work. And as you were talking about it, you know, fear is a label for all of those sensations.
Yeah.
And you were describing a different, you know, actual life-threatening situation where there's no time for that label to come in.
Right. Exactly.
There's no space for it.
There's no space. There's nobody to do it. It's
yes.
just, this is immediate. This is right here.
Yes.
And people who have been through those experiences are often in awe of the
yes.
absence of what they thought would be there.
Yes.
They thought that they would just be paralyzed.
Yes.
And they realize that, no, the paralysis, if there is one, comes later. Or this kind of thing
yes.
that this fellow describes, you know, where your sphincters and your and your heart and your lungs go mad on you. And yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. But that comes in afterwards with the story. Oh, my God.
Yes.
I could have. Oh my God! I could have died
yeah.
right then.
Yeah,
and then
blah, blah, blah,
blah,
and
blah,
then
we
you
start
feel
shaking.
The heartbeat.
And,
mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And as you were talking, I was thinking about after 9/11. I was reading the New York Times, and there was a quote from, I don't know if it was a firefighter or, but it was exactly that experience. He was just there was nothing else going on. He was just there. This thing was unfolding. There was, you know, there was no labels. There was nothing. He just had to be there.
Yes. And I think another piece of that that fits with what we talk about a lot in awareness practice, there's nobody there to have the experience.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing separate. There's just disaster. And part of that disaster is person assisting inside disaster.
Absolutely.
And, of course, our language makes them two separate things. But his experience was they're not two separate things.
Right.
He didn't have a life before or a life after. There's no alternative to this. There's no him doing this. There's just this.
Yes.
And people, again, who have those kinds of experiences. Now, I'm sure it would be so politically incorrect for him to describe this as a peak experience.
Uh-huh.
He couldn't say that because people who haven't had that experience would interpret it as unhealthy in some way,
uh-huh.
as if he were enjoying it.
Uh-huh.
And that's not the point of it. It's
yes.
a peak experience because there's the loss of that feeling of separation.
Yes.
So there's just a oneness. And
yes.
in that oneness, a lot of things happen to a person.
Uh-huh.
There's a feeling of oneness, of completeness.
Yes.
Of nothing wrong.
Uh-huh.
Even though it's a disaster, there's
right.
such a feeling of life completing itself in this
uh-huh.
moment.
Yes.
Because once again, there's no subject outside making life an object and needing to have an opinion about life in order to maintain that
yes.
subject position.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as you mentioned separation several times, I think about, you know, talking about conditioning as the illusion of separation.
Yes.
Which we seem to enjoy carrying around.
Yes.
And in those moments, there's no space for that.
That's right.
It's clear that
it falls away.
Yes.
And there is only this. This is so compelling that there's nothing outside it. So in Zen, that's talked about as a circle with no remainder.
Uh-huh.
It is complete.
Uh-huh.
And those moments when we experience them are riveting. They're life-changing. That
yes.
A person will refer back to those for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Peak experience.
Yes. And often they have that component of life-threatening. So people will talk about it, rock climbing.
Yes.
Where your attention dare not wander. You're
yes.
not going to be up on the side of a rock face daydreaming about what you're going to do at work the next week.
Yeah.
We just don't have that luxury.
Yes.
So there I am in a disaster situation. I don't know what's going to happen next.
Uh-huh.
I dare not think about what might happen next. There is no next. There's
yes.
only this, and it consumes all of me.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes. Now, Sherry, could someone have that experience in a way that's not truly life-threatening, but that yet feels...
Oh, absolutely.
You know, difficult or something is outside of my comfort zone or...
Yeah, a person can have it...
Doing something new?
Inside their comfort zone.
Uh-huh.
Because all the component that's the same in each of these situations is there is no me or I separate.
Uh-huh.
There's just experience, experiencing, experience.
Uh-huh.
Life, living life.
Uh-huh.
So the person, again, rather than experiencing him or herself outside, having opinions and ideas and perspectives about being other than the life circumstances, the person is completely in life.
Yes.
And that... Yes. That is the experience that whether people ever know it or not, they are trying to have in every moment of their lives.
Uh-huh.
It's the one, it is the experience that people seek through all kinds of circumstances and situations that actually take them farther away,
uh-huh.
which is one of life's sad little ironies.
Yes, yes. And so when there's a truly life-threatening experience, there's really no room to be in that place of conditioning or
mm-hmm.
for that illusion of separation.
Yes.
To be.
And once we get it that that's possible, we don't have to wait around for life-threatening circumstances.
Uh-huh.
We can just be completely engulfed by life.
Yes.
At any moment that we don't choose to do something other than being here.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So we talk about that stuff all the time.
Yeah.
We talk about it, in fact, so much that people forget that it's a real experience. Do you know, now being present, being here in the moment, it's cliche, which is too bad because as much as we talk about it, as much as everybody knows that's the answer, people still aren't doing it.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, yeah, I know. You just have to be in the moment. No, you have to be in the moment.
Yes.
You can't, yeah, I know. Being in the moment is the answer. No, you don't. The only time you know that is when you have the experience.
Right.
And then there's nothing cliche about it.
Yes.
Then you go, oh, I thought I knew
uh-huh.
what that meant.
Uh-huh.
I had no idea what that meant.
Yes. So knowing it intellectually does not...
Having a conditioned idea about what those words mean.
Yes.
Is definitely not the same thing as
yes.
as having the experience.
Yes, yes. And it's interesting because a lot of people know the conditioned cliche
mm-hmm.
understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And that has thrown me off, hearing people talk about that in a way that I project they understand it experientially, and then I project they don't.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of, we have a lot of good comparisons. You know, you can know for a long time everything about sex.
Right.
And then you have the experience. And you realize, intellectual understanding. I didn't even have an intellectual understanding. I just had conditionings, limited ideas about something it knew nothing about.
Absolutely.
Or the one that we do a lot. You know, we can sit here and have all these understandings about an avocado.
Yes.
You know, you've never had an avocado. I love avocados. So I'm telling you, oh, my God. You're not going to believe it. Well, they're green, and they're kind of, you know, and I go on and on forever. Or you could take a bite of avocado.
Yes.
And then we don't have to have any more conversation about it.
Right.
And you're never going to be neutral or casual about avocados again.
Yes, yes, because I will have had the experience.
You will have had the experience.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And as you talk about in The Key, your book, The Key, about, you know, an intellectual understanding of knowing how to swim is...
just not helpful when you've gone under for the third time.
Yes, yes, or riding a bike. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the only way to have the experience is to have the experience.
Yes.
Yes.
So if you haven't had the experience, then... it would be good to hop on it.
Uh-huh.
If you think you've probably had the experience, then you have to ask yourself, if the experience that people are talking about is the one I've had, why are they making such a big deal out of it? Okay? So if you haven't had one that lets you know this is a big deal, then it would be, once again, good to pursue having that experience. And then, you know, again, you're just not going to be casual about it. You know, oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, I'll be here, be present. Mm-hmm. Once you have it, you know.
It's a big deal.
It's a very big deal.
Yes.
Yeah. And that when people say that, if they in fact know what they're talking about, they're talking about something that's a very big deal. It's like the breath.
Uh-huh.
You know, oh, yeah, I know, breathe. Yeah.
Come back to
the breath. Come back to, well, not even come back to the breath, but just breathe. Oh, yeah, I know, breathe. Mm-hmm, uh-huh. Well, if you don't have any air, it's amazing how big a deal the breath is.
Yes.
But if you've just approached it as breath, you know, breathing, what's the big deal about that? Well, that's because you've never had any alternative experience.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So the fact that something has always been there, has always been easy, you've never been required to have any other kind of perspective, doesn't mean there isn't a different perspective to be had.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I have this happen all the time with people with aging.
Uh-huh.
You know, I watch people age, and it's just funny because every single person thinks that they're going to be the exception. And then it's like they hit 35 and they start looking at their bodies and they're going, oh my God, what is happening? How can this be? You know, I've always been young.
Yes.
And they don't know that everybody else who's older than they are also had the same experience. And then there are the people who are 10 years younger who have no idea what you're talking about and just know that you're pathetic.
Pathetic 35-year-old.
Yes.
And I know
old
you,
person.
Yeah, I know you didn't pick 35 for any particular. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. It's great to be here. My name's Michael Gray. I'm the host of the show. Today we have a special recorded show, so please don't call us today. Call us next week when Sherry will be back. If you want to contact us in the meantime, you can send us an email to openair@kzsu.org. Sherry, I have some emails here, some email questions from people, and I think we'd get some good action here. Hello, Michael and Sherry. I've really been seeing how the voices of conditioning are contradictory, untruthful, and make no sense. So now my attention is on watching for the automatic tendency to believe them. A feeling of unease is a clue. I've been working with the mini workshop sheets from your new book, When You're Falling, Dive, and that has been extremely helpful. I often find it difficult to know immediately what aspect of the personality I'm identifying with, but there is never any question about what the voices are saying. Out it spews in a negative torrent of random blame and directives. You should, you shouldn't, stop, go, what's the matter with you, you're wrong, etc., etc. Doing this process has made it much more obvious how irrelevant their message is to my life, if I don't believe them. Do you have any suggestions on catching the belief process in the act?
Well, of course, the biggest suggestion of all is paying attention.
Uh-huh.
And what occurs to me when you're reading that is that where most of us stumble is not over which aspect of the personality is there. So, for instance, I suddenly decide that what I need to do is quit my job, sell everything I've got, and move to Tahiti.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a brilliant idea. Brilliant idea.
Brilliant.
And in fact, I regret the fact that I have had this brilliant idea on numerous occasions previously, and I didn't act on them.
Mm-hmm.
So now I've wasted most of my life.
Uh-huh.
And if I had just done the right thing years ago, then I would be happily living in Tahiti right now.
Yes.
And so I present this idea to my partner, who says, I don't think that's a good idea. You know, what about the children? What about, what about the mortgage? What about the...
Uh-huh.
And the part of me who is there, identified with this perspective, doesn't have children,
mm-hmm.
doesn't care about the mortgage, doesn't like the job, just wants to live in Tahiti,
uh-huh.
okay? Doesn't actually care about the partner, right? Now, if that's going on, what we do is identify that person. So let's call that person, the hopeless romantic or the impossible dreamer or
uh-huh.
something like that.
Free
now,
spirit.
There are probably people out there who would say, well, what's wrong with that? Why don't they just go? And, okay, let's agree that that's the case. But what is true about this person is that he or she also has strong personalities of the parent, is passionate about the work, is a devoted member of three or four organizations and
uh-huh.
completely supportive of those. So this impossible dreamer is just one of many personalities.
Uh-huh.
Now, when we catch on to that, what most people want to do is say, okay, how do I get rid of that person? Because
uh-huh.
that's a pain to, it's disruptive.
Yeah.
It just doesn't help me to have that personality.
Yes.
It's not a problem that that person exists. Any problem that we have is because of who we're identified with
mm-hmm.
in relationship to that personality.
Uh-huh.
So if I am in a place of what I call conscious compassionate awareness, and this person comes up and starts making plans to go to Tahiti, I just go, wow. You're tired of all this, aren't you? And probably it has been a stressful time and life is difficult and unsatisfying and, you really need a vacation.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, nobody else gives this person a vacation. So then they finally just get to the point of, I've just got to chuck it all and go to Tahiti. That's the only hope. So conscious compassion awareness would say, all right, well, go ahead and make those plans. But in the meantime, why don't we take 3 or 4 days and just go to the mountains and get in the boat and kick back and
mm-hmm.
okay, knowing that it's very likely that with a little rest, that person
uh-huh.
is going to have their needs met and
uh-huh.
slip back in. If I get identified with righteous judgment, then that aspect of the personality comes up. What is the matter with you? This is completely stupid. You are so irresponsible. I can't believe that you come up with these wild ideas, no wonder you haven't done better in your career. Somebody who comes up with these ideas obviously can't be trusted. You are so immature. Okay? So in scene one, the person is there, and it winds up, it brings us 3 or 4 days in the country. Okay? Scene two, the person is there, and it's a trip to self-hatred and misery.
Yes.
So it's never the aspect of the personality. Because aspects of the personality always are bringing us something useful, interesting, entertaining, helpful. It's how we respond to them that makes our lives pleasant or unpleasant.
Yes.
And that's across the board. It's how we respond to the aspects of ourselves. It's how we respond to everything in life. We think we have to change the things that we perceive as wrong or difficult. The only thing that needs to happen is for us to disidentify from someone whose job it is to judge and criticize and hate, come back to a place of conscious, compassionate awareness, and then whatever is going on, we respond to it with compassionate, conscious awareness.
Yes.
Now, somebody out there is raising their hand going, and how does anything ever get done? Are you saying that we just accept everything as it is? There are things in this world that need to be changed. Okay?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, of course, that's a conditioned belief that when we're operating out of conscious, compassionate awareness, nothing happens. So I always go to one of my primo heroes, Gandhi, who, using conscious, compassionate awareness, made one of the biggest changes in the history of humanity.
Yes.
Yeah. Freed a nation using conscious, compassionate awareness.
Oh, wow. Sherry, as you were talking about these aspects of the personality, I was taken back to our show last week when you were talking with the caller about different aspects of the personality and the clothes that they wear. So tell me if this is a good overview. When we talk about aspects of the personality, we're talking about internal aspects of how we interact in the world. And as we go through our day, we may become what we call identified with one or more of those aspects. So we may take on the role of worker or parent or partner. And as you were talking about in this example, when we're present, we can be aware of the needs of all of those aspects within us.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So this morning, I woke up, and I woke up to a phone call, and the phone call was from a friend. So for a period of time, I was a friend. And then the part of me came in who said, now this is very nice, but you have to be to a completely different part of the state in a really short period of time, and you're not packed. So then the person who is incredibly organized and hopped in. But then the part of me raised its little hand and said, what about exercise? So that part of me put on its little outfit and went to the gym and got on the treadmill for a period of time.
Yes.
And then there, and then I had to go to the office. So there's the person who works in the office and who needed to have her little things to work with during the coming week. So we had to pack those up. Then another person was there who wasn't feeling well, not in me, but an actual person. So then the part of me comes out who is a caregiver. Okay, well, you know, can I get you anything? What do you need? Then the person who needs to get packed and be in a different part of the state is going, okay, we've been fooling around long enough, and starts ticking things off. Okay, there's, you don't have time to clean the car. Okay, you don't have time to... So all of those different aspects of the personality arising. Now, this was in probably, I just described a 3-hour period.
Yes. All of those different aspects.
Yeah. And then there was the person who wanted to leave the house in such a way that it would be a pleasure to come back to. So in the midst of all of this is somebody who's doing up dishes and wiping down counters and arranging the laundry and all of those things. Yeah.
Yes. Fascinating. And I, as you were talking, I had this vision of what we often talk about as a mentor, who's someone who is present and is seeing all of these aspects of the personality and sort of managing among them.
Yes. Yes. not, again, if we go back to that, there could have been somebody there saying, you are so neurotic. Just get over it.
Uh-huh.
Leave the stuff. You don't need to let why are you?
Yes.
Okay. Having a mentor,
yeah,
as you described, someone who is really assisting. It's okay, you know, you're going to get it done. It's fine. You know, you're doing a good job. Oh, good. Oh, you remember that? That's very good.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Kind of like your own little cheerleading section.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Then it makes life fun.
Yeah.
Instead of, so for me, as you well know, life comes down to those two things. Everything in life is going to be the same.
Uh-huh.
The content of life is completely irrelevant. What happens in life is absolutely irrelevant. The only thing that matters is how we respond to it. So if,
yes,
I'm there from that mentor, compassionate, conscious awareness place, then all of the different aspects of me are coming up and they're interacting with life and learning and doing and playing and participating.
Yes.
And it's fun.
Yeah.
If I were to let it slide over into that judgmental, critical, self-hating,
yes,
the very same things are happening in life, and I am having a miserable time.
Yes. Makes all the difference.
It does.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds so simple, but the difference is just night and day.
Yes. Yes.
As heaven and hell. It's the difference,
uh-huh,
the difference between heaven and hell, truly,
yes.
Which,
yes,
is what the Buddha taught. You know, this is samsara. This is nirvana.
Yes.
If you are identified from that conditioned place and you're in self-judgment and criticism and self-hatred, you are in samsara. You are in the world of suffering. And you can be having the best life circumstances in the world and you are in the world of suffering.
Yes.
Or on the other side, you can be having extremely difficult, challenging life circumstances. And if you are coming at it from that place of conscious, compassionate awareness and have that mentoring energy there to support you and guide you, then it's nirvana.
Home free.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reminded me of what we were talking about earlier about being present and sort of knowing that from an intellectual perspective and really knowing it and being there.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Really worth having. Way more beneficial, wonderful, helpful than trying to fix yourself and fix the world.
Uh-huh.
Just find the conscious, compassionate awareness and live in that.
Yes.
You suddenly have everything you want.
Wow.
Leave that, and no matter how we scramble around, no matter what we're able to accomplish or do, it's never satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Exciting.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. My name's Michael Gray. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we're back. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. My name is Michael Gray. If you want to find out more about what Sherry's doing, you can check out her website, which is sherryhuber.com. Also, we're not taking calls this week, so please call us again next week. In the meantime, if you want to drop us an email, if you have a question or a comment, please send an email to openair@kzsu.org. We've been talking a lot about fear today, Sherry, and now we have another email question. How do you describe the difference between flow or peak experience and the Zen Buddhist meditative state?
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. We've sort of been talking about that in a lot of these other things, haven't we?
Yeah, in the sense of presence.
Yeah,
so
the firefighter or whoever that was that,
yes,
you were talking about.
Yes.
Athletes. I'm always fascinated by athletes describing what happens with them when they're in the zone or they're,
yes,
playing out of their minds or,
yes,
that sort of thing. We hear it with soldiers.
Uh-huh.
A lot of stories of men who will say that the rest of their lives were paled in comparison to the aliveness that they felt when they were in battle.
Uh-huh.
Now, we could say, well, gosh, that must have been scary, though.
Yes.
And yet, as we were talking about earlier, to be so completely there.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing left over. None of that, a little minute ago, talking about the critical voice, you know, the,
yes.
Why didn't you, why didn't you? In those kinds of situations, that voice has nothing to say.
Yes.
There's just, you used the term earlier, there's no room for it.
Yes.
And that's it. There's just no room for it. And to me, that's what were the flow?
Difference between
peak
flow
experience.
Or peak experience and the Zen Buddhist meditative state.
Yeah. And so, of course, the point that I'm always trying to make to people is they're the same.
They're the same. And, that's the short answer.
That's the short answer to it. It's exactly the same.
Yes.
Because when the illusion of separation drops away, then there's just life living.
Yes.
And it's all of the things that dreams are made of. It's uh-huh. It's where we're going. It's what we want. And a lot of times we see people reaching that state through doing these things. Either, again, the rock climber,
yes.
who is, it's just so life-threatening that they have to be there. The super athlete, it's not life-threatening. And yet, it seems to me there are two components. One, the love of the game, the love,
yes.
the pure love of what they're doing.
Yes.
And also, there's an element of being willing to give everything.
Yes.
Again, no room for anything like self-consciousness or. Being concerned about how you look or what people think of you.
Yes.
We know with people who are painters or do music or that kind of creative avenue, they will talk about doing what they do because they have to. They have to. They're just driven to create.
Uh-huh.
And they're not creating with one eye on the critics. They're not painting, anticipating what somebody is going to say about the painting,
yes.
or about the piece of music. They just, it's inside them. They have to get it out.
Yes.
They have to express it.
Yes.
And any of us can live in that way.
Yes.
It's available to all of us.
Yes.
It's just that so often conditioning in the form of being safe, worrying about how I'll look, what will people think of me, is stronger mm-hmm. than the amount of passion.
Uh-huh.
It's funny because people ask me all the time about passion. First of all, people assume that doing something like a meditation practice removes the passion from your life,
yes.
which is funny to me because in my experience, it's exactly the opposite yes. of that. What removes passion from our lives is all this, as we say in Zen, crapola, that people focus on instead of just doing what their heart wants them to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's being practical and concerned and responsible and adult and, you know, well, what about retirement? You know, you don't. So constantly, the life force is there. There's this. You know, now we might be back to go to Tahiti. You know, there are times
right.
when moving to Tahiti, Gauguin followed that impulse to great success. Although
uh-huh.
there are probably still people who would say, but what about his wife and kids? And, you know, there is something to be said about that. However, following that dream, that impulse, that finally, listening to what the heart says. I mean, we get story after story after story about people having their lives just completely transformed
uh-huh.
through one day just saying, I don't care. You know,
yes.
I might not live long enough to retire. Or
yes.
It doesn't matter if I die with all this money and I haven't done this thing. I'm gonna regret it. So I just have to do it.
Yes.
So that kind of following that impulse, going with the heart, the passion is there. the conditioning can't compete because the force, the life force is flowing.
Yes.
And the person is lit up and turned on and sparked and alive and plugged in, and you know, conditioning just doesn't stand a chance.
Yes.
So is that a peak experience? Well, maybe. Oftentimes, a peak experience is so arresting for someone because it's of a relatively short duration. It's just like, you know, all of a sudden you're plugged into 240 current,
yes,
you know, and you've been a 40-watt light bulb, right? And suddenly, for a short period of time, you're plugged into 240, and it's like,
yes.
But there's that feeling of, well, I don't know if you could maintain it. Most people don't. You know, it passes away, and then it becomes like an island, you know, a reference point of,
yes,
you know, when my life was really... but if we are doing a regular practice of dropping that illusion of a separate self, not supporting the ego, turning to the heart, and allowing life to live us, then we have more and more of those moments. They may not be of the 240 variety. Those still may be interspersed.
Yes.
But everything. So, you know, I was a 40-watt bulb. Now I'm a 150-watt bulb all the time.
Yes.
Or now I'm a 300-watt bulb all the time.
Yes.
And so it's not that great jump. And yet it's the constant that I'm on is so wonderful. So if I'm operating at 40 watts and suddenly I get a few days at 1,000, mm-hmm, that's gonna catch my attention.
Yeah.
Now if I go right back to being 40 because it was just an accident, then 40 is going to be very unsatisfying.
Yes.
But if I go back to 300, if I can sustain my life there, then life is going to be very, very good.
Yes.
And if I never get another 1,000, well, hey, it was great while it lasted.
It's much higher than 40.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
So we don't have control over these things. I'm fond of saying, you know, we can't make life give us anything, but we can certainly make ourselves available in case there's anything to be given out.
We're ready to receive.
We're ready to receive it.
Hands are open.
Hands are open. And that attitude of mind, and here's the magic, with that attitude of mind, life is always giving to you.
Yes.
Being ready to receive is an attitude that can only happen to someone who is already receiving.
That's interesting.
Yes.
So it's, can you say that again?
It's magical. Yeah. When you're somebody who looks at life from a point of view of abundance, that's because you're already receiving.
Yes.
So you're receiving, you recognize you're receiving, you don't allow conditioning to take you back to that 40-watt place where all you're focused on is, yeah, but I don't have that, and they have one of those, and I don't have one of those, and why? So we...
Yeah. Lack, and deprivation.
Exactly. Instead, I'm in that attitude of receiving. So if we stay with this 40-watt business, okay? So I realize I'm at 40, and I realize that my little light could go out at any moment. So I'm just pretty darn happy to be at 40. And that happiness... from being at 40, suddenly I'm a little brighter.
Yes.
And then I recognize that, and I feel really grateful that things are brightening. And then it's a little brighter. And it just keeps building in that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So, yeah, yeah. It's magical. It seems magical.
Yes.
And it kind of is magical.
Yes.
But it is also the way life works.
Yes.
So we all the time, again, we see lots of people who have everything in the world, and they're in loss, lack, and deprivation.
Yes.
Victims and miserable, and life isn't working, and they, you know, you think, well, how could you be so decked out and look so unhappy? And then you see people who really ought to be unhappy. They should. You know, they're poor and nothing is going their way, and it probably never has. And they're just appreciative, grateful for everything they've got.
Yes.
And they're a bright light.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Great stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, do we have just a minute or?
We do.
Okay. I can't remember if we talked about this, but with the work in Africa, that's the main point that I want to make with people. I want people to go there. I don't want people to give me money and I'll go there, although I do, of course, because I love to go there and want to. But I want people to go there so that they will see that all of our American projections onto how unhappy these people are, how they're suffering, how miserable they are. I can't look at them because it'll just be too painful, too horrible. You go there and you look into these people's eyes and you say to yourself, at least I did, these people have something that almost nobody has where I live.
Uh-huh.
There's a joy at being alive, not because life is going in a certain way, but just life itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so two messages I want Americans to get. One is to go there and have the experience for yourself, because I project what people will see is that these people are not unhappy. They are hungry.
Uh-huh.
And when we go somewhere and we meet people, and we see them as friends, we don't want our friends to be hungry.
Yes.
And we realize that there is much that we can do to help. And the second thing I want people to get is it's not necessary to go into loss, lack, and deprivation in order to help somebody else.
Yes.
You don't have to sell your car and take the money to Africa.
Yes.
Or even down the street to the nearest poverty-stricken neighborhood in your own area. There's so much that we can do that brings joy to us and brings the wherewithal to make a difference in other people's lives at the same time. So yes. The kind of thing that I mean, we just heard from a gal in San Diego that she'd gotten her friends together. They put on a yard sale, made $800 and some.
Wow.
And they're sending it to Zimbabwe.
Great.
I'm doing a workshop around the 20th of August, something like that, down in Felton, which is near Santa Cruz. And the proceeds go to the Zimbabwe Fund. I was talking with the gal who cuts my hair, and I said, yeah, like, for instance, I was telling her this there. I said, a person could, say, cut hair for a morning, and the proceeds could go. So something that makes the giving a fun proposition.
Yes.
So, whatever you're doing, you put a little sign out, you've got the pictures of the kids and this is what I'm doing this for. And it just feels good all the way around. And then the best thing is to make the money and then get on the plane and go over there and turn the money over, hand it to the person who's going to go buy the food.
Uh-huh.
Or better yet, go with them.
Yes.
And pick up the sacks of food and bring it back and roll up your sleeves and help cook it. And watch those kids eat it, and that there's not a single problem on the face of this earth that together we can't turn around.
Wow. That's exciting.
It's very exciting. It is, it's thrilling, in fact.
Yes, as we were talking about the whole show today, being in that place.
Being in that place is thrilling. Yes. Really being here is thrilling.
Yes.
And it's lovely to be here with you.
Great. It's great to be here. I've had a lovely time today.
Let's do it again.
Let's do it again. Coming up today at 6 p.m., we have DJ Decca with At the Cafe Bohemian. Then at 9 p.m., we have The Bod of Euphony. Sherry, that's really exciting, talking about the work in Africa. And one word that comes to mind as you talk about that is responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like I can take responsibility for myself. I can take responsibility for everything. And I've heard you talk about that, not in the sense of...
Not fault.
Not fault, not credit.
Not blame.
Right, right.
Just this is my world, and I'm responding.
Uh-huh. I live in this world. I'm a part of it.
Yes.
I can contribute to it.
Yes.
I'm
responding.
Uh-huh. I'm responding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm responding to what I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
And that can expand as far as we want it to. And in my experience, the more it expands, the more joyous life becomes.
Mm. The more it expands, the more joyous life becomes. Mm-hmm. The more that awareness of how we are
larger,
in the world.
The larger the container.
Uh-huh.
The larger the container, the more joy it can hold.
Wow. The larger the container, the more joy it can hold.
Yeah. So we want to be the biggest container that we can possibly be.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sounds great. Sherry, would you like to give our readers some homework for next week when you're back, and then people can call and talk about it?
I would like for us to stay with this little theme and maybe look at some of the things that people focus on in their lives that brings them joy.
Uh-huh. That expands the container.
That expands
so to speak.
The container. Yeah. What are the times of joy? What are the things that people focus on, contribute to, take responsibility for? And they can be big things, and they can be tiny things.
Uh-huh. Exciting.
Somebody was talking, in fact, I think it was last week, about having a moment, and I think it was a homework thing, having a moment of realizing that there was self-judgment and criticism, and then stopping that and turning that into kindness, and how transformative that experience was.
Wow.
So, you know, that's huge, and yet it's a very tiny, in the big picture, that's something manageable for all of us. Any of us could do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's exciting. So please call us next week. Sherry will be back. If you have a question in the meantime, you can email us at openair@kzsu.org. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for joining us today. And
for our wonderful staff.
And for our wonderful staff.
Yeah, Jay and Lori, who are stalwarts here helping us make this happen every week.
Yes, it's wonderful to have a great team of everybody
Yes,
here.
It is.
All right, see you next week.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.